From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Life. I'm Mike Canary. Thanks for joining us. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated on April 4th, 1968, while standing on the balcony outside of his room in the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. That was the day after he'd given his I've Been to the Mountaintop speech, which ends with him talking about the possibility of an untimely death. On today's show, we're discussing the play The Mountaintop by Katori Hall, which is the fictional account of a conversation Dr. King had with a hotel maid just after delivering that famous speech. It's currently running at the Alliance for the Arts in Fort Myers and will close on Sunday the 26th. On today's show, we're joined by the two actors in the play and its director. Derek Lively is an actor, playwright, and screenwriter who has been living in Fort Myers since relocating from New York City in 2015. Derek, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be here.
Sonia McCarter is a director, actress, and mentor, as well as community engagement coordinator at the Alliance for the Arts in Fort Myers. Sonia, thanks for being here again.
Thank you for having us.
And Rick Sebastian is the show's director, but he's also done his share of acting over the years. Rick, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
To engage with us and your fellow listeners about this conversation or any of our shows, find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media or on Twitter. We're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So for starters, I want to see how familiar each of you were with this play prior to the decision to produce it and whether any of you had seen it. Sonia, let's start with you.
Okay, so I'm going to give you a little background.
Sure.
So we have been partnering with the Dunbar Festival Committee to bring the arts, more of the arts, theater, visual arts, to the festival, the celebration weekend. So last year, we put on a program called Podiums to the Pulpit, and I believe we did a show here telling everyone about what that was. And we were looking forward to the next year, and I'm like, oh my gosh, okay, we want to do something that really centers around MLK, but I can't think of any play that is just, you know, featuring MLK. And I was like, hold up. Samuel Jackson and Angela Bassett did The Mountaintop on Broadway. So then I got the play, I read the play, and I went to Bill, who is the artistic director, and said, this is something we could do. He got the rights within that week. So I had never... I don't know where I saw it. I don't know how it came back to my memory.
So you hadn't seen it when it was on Broadway or prior in any of its productions?
I just remembered that they had done it on Broadway and that it was applauded by not only the writing of Katori Hall, but their performance. So I figured it would be something worth looking into, and yeah, it is.
Yeah, and when you read it the first time, I mean, did it hit you like it hit me when I looked through it?
It's
really, it's a really interesting piece.
Yeah, it hit me for a number of reasons, some of which I'll expound on and some not, because I don't want to give away things in the play. However, his humanity hit me. Mm. I had never really thought, we have that hero worship,
sure,
kind of,
yeah,
idea. So to me, he was an icon. To me, he was almost like one of those biblical characters,
uh-huh,
where you read about it, but you don't really think of them as a real person. So that is one of the major things that hit me when I read it the first time.
Derek, what about you?
I actually lived in New York at the time it was on Broadway.
Okay.
I didn't see it. I remember the notices were kind of mixed for it.
Okay.
But it did well at the box office. It actually did better in London in terms of notices. There's a lot of reasons for that, but I actually met the playwright. I auditioned for her once.
Really? Really?
So, yeah, for another play of hers. So I wasn't really that familiar with the play itself until I read it a few months ago.
Mm-hmm.
Just thought it was like, you know, a pretty powerful piece.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of what she's portraying and what she's going after. And it was pretty well developed, the play. Where it was developed, I'm familiar with the place in New York, so... yeah, that was pretty much my history with it. Yeah,
okay.
I never saw it, but I knew of it.
Okay, and Rick, what about you?
I had never heard of, seen, or knew anything about the play. I knew, of course, about Martin Luther King. I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area and was living there when he did the initial march in 64 and was in D.C. again after his assassination when there were riots and burning in D.C. that affected everything. But... to know the man's background, and as it's revealed in this play, was all new material for me. And the thing that I enjoyed most about my initial read on the play was how the mix of from very serious topic to light humor to serious humor that kept you from getting just morbidly entrenched in a sad song. It's a very good dramatic mix of highs and lows, comedy and tragedy.
Can you give an overview for our listeners of what the show's about?
Well, this is April the 3rd, 1968, in Memphis. He's come back to finish the march that had been started the week before that had broken out in violence when people toward the rear of the march were looting and stealing TVs, and that's mentioned in the play. So he had left town and to great criticism, and he had to be talked into mostly by Ralph Abernathy, who was a close associate of his, along with Jesse Jackson, to come back and to finish the march the correct way. So he's come back to town. He has a serious cold. He's weak from that and from all the criticism that has happened. So he's just delivered the speech, that final speech, the mountaintop, where he talks about, where I may not get there with you, that he's now brought back to the motel. The other men, he's tired. He wants to just, you know, go to bed. And the other men are going to buy food and cigarettes and stuff. And so he comes into the room, and this is where a fictional account now happens. This is what Katori Hall has created. What if? What's going through this man's mind? How does he feel at this time? And what is the personal history that has gotten him to this point? What is the personal cost and sacrifice of our heroes to get to this point? So he tries to call his wife. She doesn't answer. Needs a cup of coffee, calls down to room service and asks, could you bring up a cup of coffee to me? And a housekeeper brings him a cup of coffee. And that's where the play starts to take off.
I read the play. I did a lot of research in coming to this. It's very powerful. As actors, what is it like to be channeling that much power in a story like this? Sonia or Derek? Well. Yeah, she pointed. You each pointed to each other.
Okay, so for me, it was a lot of moments of, okay, can we just stop for a moment and just let the weight of this, can we just feel the weight of what's being said, the weight of this man's life and what he had to endure, and the challenge to us then as the recipients of all of his sacrifices to, you know, as he it says in the play, pick up the baton and continue the work. That for me was the biggest impact. What am I now doing to make sure that his legacy doesn't die, that we've continued on his work? And it comes back to me through our rehearsals, through my own personal time of just going through my lines and reading about his life is my responsibility. It's heavy. It's weighty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Derek?
I think one thing that's important to note about the play and about the circumstances, what was going on at the time, was that Dr. King actually wanted to return to Memphis. It was very important to him to return to Memphis. The men and women of his organization, of his movement, the SCLC, did not want to return. So therefore, that where the conflict
there
was.
There was tension there. Yeah, yeah.
There was a lot of tension.
He was broadening his mission.
He was broadening, exactly. So he wanted to be there. And they were like, no, this is not bad. We should fight now. And actually, there's a great documentary where Andy Young talks about how it's called King in the Wilderness, how Dr. King cussed them out because they did not support him with this. He's like, we're doing this. And they're like, Martin, you can't do that. We don't want to do this. This is not where we should be headed. So it's very interesting how he took that, again, additional personal sacrifice to be there when he didn't have to be there. He felt that he should be there, which I think gives a lot more weight to this play. I think for me, the first thing to do is to basically eradicate the notion of the icon. Let's just strip that out the way. Let's just get rid of it. Here's the man who accomplished extraordinary things. A very failed man, as most people are failed.
Mm-hmm. And the play does not shy away from that.
The play does not shy away from it, which is what I love about the play and love about what she's written, which is one of the reasons why I think when it first hit New York, people weren't ready for it.
Oh.
So it was a different King that which they had seen.
Right.
So therefore, people were kind of like, ooh, wait a minute. Whereas in London, people are like, wow, this is because they're more detached from it. So which now I think is a great time for the play because now we're more used to seeing people to a certain extent, more human than we have in the past because there's been a lot of biopics about people and that sort of thing. So our heroes are now becoming maybe more human, but Dr. King is still different.
Yes, he is.
And in certain areas, he's still different. So I think the thing is just approaching it from a standpoint of pretty much living with this man for a very long time. And I mean daily almost, to a point where I kind of sometimes see him in my dreams. And really making sure that I took the time and process step by step to really analyze what's going on, where he's going, so on and so forth, and that it would be a slow road to find a way to get there. Get there, but you know, it's different than, you know, actors approach different roles differently. You have to. You can't approach every role the same.
Yeah.
So you have to look at something like this. Okay, this is who this is. This is what happened. This is in the context. Now I have to literally go back layer by layer, piece by piece, and analyze every step and know exactly what this means, what that means. Go to Memphis, which I did. And really just take those steps back. Whereas, you know, so it's not where you just, okay, what's happening in this scene? Okay, this is what's happening. Okay, go.
Yeah.
It's more so like, okay, what is the full story of this man? And then there's other technical things. It's a very, as much as there's a lot of emotion, which there's a lot of emotion, there's also a lot of technical stuff that has to happen for the actor in this. So, but that's a whole nother conversation.
Do you, is that your method in general, or was there something about this play that made you want to get deeper by going to Memphis, for instance?
It's my method depending on the role. It's my method in general, but depending on the role. But I don't think I would have been able to live with myself if I had not gone to Memphis and actually go to where he was assassinated and to kind of walk those steps and to see where it was and to go to the Civil Rights Museum and to see that whole journey, because we're talking about a man who lived with constant death threats for 12 years. That's a long time. Bombing your house, and not just his house. There are other incredible men and women of that movement whose homes were bombed, whose lives were threatened, whose lives are on the line. He was the face of it, and so therefore he had to endure more. But think about that, 12 years, being stabbed in the chest at 29. It's just amazing.
Well, that's what I was going to say too, is you know, I knew when I learned about him, presumably, that he was as young as he was when he was killed. But he was really young. You know, I think when I learned about it, 39 seemed old. And now I'm
Tell me about it.
I'm like, he was 39 years old. Yeah. But he had also been the leader of the CLPC, is it?
CLC
for 12 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I will say that, you know, going back and watching the video of the end of that speech after having read this play, amazingly, it is more powerful.
Yes.
I mean, that's a great work of art right there. Yeah. If you can go back to a historical moment and it's more powerful than it used to be, you know.
And it was off the cuff.
Really?
So it wasn't like he had this speech written and he just performed it. It was pretty much off the cuff. So he thought he was coming down with the flu that night. And as Rick said, you know, his close associate and friend, Ralph Abernathy, basically said, Martin, we have like thousands of people here. They want to see you. You got to come here. He was in his pajamas. And basically he pretty much, and I have a recording of Andy Young basically saying it was typical Martin, a lot of stuff that he had said before. He had said many of those things before. Because he did, if you listen to a lot of his speeches, he does extrapolate certain things. Because
sure.
I Have a Dream was not the first time he had said that.
Right.
He had actually said it for a speech with Aretha Franklin's father, who's a minister. And there was a big rally that they had in Detroit. He actually said, I had the I Have a Dream speech then, and that was before the March on Washington. So he would extrapolate and he would repeat it. But that night, there was something different and electric about it. Very electric about it, that it was off the cuff, a lot of it, even though he repeated some of the things that he had said before. And I've listened to that speech entirety many, many times. He covers a big gamut, but one thing that always strikes me in that speech, he talks about the Birmingham movement. And it's almost like somebody looking back on, this is what we did in this movement back in this particular day, and we did this and accomplished that. And it's kind of almost like he's looking back and saying, wow. And then talking about what we need to do now, and it's just amazing. But the end of it is riveting.
And it makes you wonder, you know, if he hadn't been killed the next day, whether that would have just been another speech he gave, or if somehow the fact that he was killed made the end of it seem so prescient, because it does seem so prescient.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
Rick, can you talk some about, you know, how you approach this as a director? You know, you're given a text, you've got actors, you've got a stage. Talk some about, you know, putting this all together for stage.
Well, the first thing I looked at, because she's very explicit on Katori Hall, the playwright, on the fact that this all takes, all the action takes place in the room 306 at the Lorraine Motel. So I had to do a lot of research to find out, okay, what does that look like? What are we going to achieve as far as recreating that and be theatrical at the same time, to be able to move around in the context of a motel room and be able to tell the story? Then the playwright has a very good preamble to the play in the copy that we get, where she's done a lot of research. So there was a lot to learn there. And then we now have the internet, where if there's anything more of a question, you can go and look it up. I'm more of a visual person, so I was looking at images of the period of the time, the initial strike, the initial death of the two sanitation workers who were killed by just trying to keep out of the rain by hiding in the truck, and a malfunction, which had been known about, caused the truck to activate and killed them, which was the causative incident of the initial strike by the workers there in Memphis. So for me, it's more of a mechanical thing of saying, how can I make this work? And then looking into, what is this character, these two characters, how do they interact? I said, we already said there's something mysterious about the housekeeper, but she's more than just a confidant to give him somebody to reveal things to. It takes about a third of the play to get into the fact of revealing something of why she is mysterious and why she's really there. The monologues that Derek performs as Dr. Martin Luther King reveal so much about him personally, his background, his hopes, his dreams, and fills in the history of why they're there, what, and what he wants for the future. I mean, Derek's already said he was already planning another big march to Washington to include not just the civil rights movement, but all peoples.
And it doesn't, from reading it, it doesn't seem like it's probably that long, right? I mean, like, what's the approximate runtime?
Because it runs without an intermission.
Right.
It'll run about 75 minutes.
Oh, okay. It's easier to read. First time I've really read a script like that.
Well, the playwright has done a great job in writing her script of kind of earmarking where the emotional areas are. Mm-hmm. She writes in pauses. She writes in slashes, ellipses. Mm-hmm. So they'd say, this requires a little attention, which from a dramatist's point of view, this is where the audience sees the character thinking, but also it gives a chance for the audience to think about what was just said and involve them, that now they're invested in the story.
If you're just joining the show today, we're talking with Rick Sebastian. He's the director of the play The Mountaintop by Katori Hall. That's opening on January 16th and runs through the 26th at the Alliance for the Arts in Fort Myers. We're also joined in studio by two of the actors, or the two actors in the play, Derek Lively and Sonia McCarter. To add your thoughts, please find us on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. One of the tidbits that you learn in the research for the show, or I learned, is that the playwright's mom was a teenager in Memphis, and her mom wouldn't let her go to the mountaintop speech. That's all historically accurate,
yes.
Sonia?
Yes. She and Katori puts this in the preface of the play, that the character Cam May is named after her mom, mm-hmm. whose name is Karen May, and they called her Cam May, and that at 15, she actually went to the first march where all of the for the Memphis sanitation workers, where all the violence erupted. So when King came back the second time, her mom wouldn't let her go because the first one ended in violence, and she was, you know, concerned for her daughter, so she wouldn't let her attend again.
You'd mentioned earlier the passing the baton as being one of the themes of this. Can you reflect a little bit more on that? And maybe, Derek, you know, you already said that it's become part of your mindset a little bit. Does that resonate with you, Derek?
I think because I've been so ingrained with him and what I need to do, I haven't really looked at it from a personal standpoint.
Interesting. Yet. That was going to be one of my other questions, is how do you separate the emotional impact as you.
Yeah.
I mean, you want to have emotional content in him when you play it, but I guess you have to compartmentalize that.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you discover yourself in every role, but the discovering for me is more of a personal nature. And what I mean by that is in terms of his flaws and my own flaws as a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at that and how even though whatever you're going through, continuing and persisting because you have a job to do and you have something that you need to get done and to accomplish. So in other words, the greater societal impact of everything, no, that's not anything that's not something as an actor that I really look at when I'm immersed in something. It's something that I might think about later when I reflect upon it, but not during, no. At least not for me personally.
Understood.
Yeah. So can I just
absolutely
say this for me? Part of the reason why it impacts me so much is because right now I am passionate about using the arts to address issues of social justice. And sometimes that can be scary because we want to create spaces where people can have some very tough conversations. We want to make sure that not only there that we have equity and access, that we're being inclusive, but we are also bringing as many people to the table as possible to share our thoughts and to for people to feel brave to have those conversations. And sometimes I want to shy away from that because I know that it can be tough and I don't know how others will receive it or respond to it. So for this play for me, it was galvanizing in that this is part of I feel like it is my calling to, in this area, Southwest Florida, to use the arts to convene conversations on things that matter in our community and that affect our community.
Well, we are happy to be able to help spread that.
And can I just add something?
Absolutely.
Sonia's doing an amazing job. I've been, you know, in the 2 years that I've known and worked with her, I've just seen amazing things that she's doing in terms of the arts in the community. And I just think that it's just so incredible to see in terms of what she's trying to do. And I know that, you know, she's gonna really make some great things happen. So yeah, I just want to basically put that out there because sometimes we can think it and I can tell you that. But you know, I want the world to
know.
Now
it's on the record.
Now it's on the record.
Okay, well, like I said, believe it or not, that is all the time we have for today's show. I want to thank my guests. Derek Lively is an actor, playwright, and screenwriter. He's playing Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in the upcoming production of The Mountaintop at the Alliance for the Arts in Fort Myers. Derek, thank you.
Thank you.
Sonia McCarter co-stars with Derek in the play, and she's a director, actress, and mentor, and community engagement coordinator at the Alliance for the Arts. Sonia, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Rick Sebastian is the show's director. Rick, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
The Mountaintop is now open and runs until this Sunday, January 26th. You can find details on our website, wgcu.org/GCL. If you missed any of today's show, you can always hear episodes in their entirety on our website, or you can subscribe to our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. Our show today was produced by yours truly. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Life is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Mike Kinnairy. This is WGCU. WCU FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida. We're going to conclude today's show by listening back to the end of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s last speech given on April 3rd, 1968 at the Mason Temple in Memphis, Tennessee. This segment starts with him talking about the many letters he received while in the hospital after being stabbed in the chest at a book signing.
They allowed me to read some of the mail that came in and from all over the states and the world, kind letters came in. I read a few, but one of them I will never forget. I had received one from the president and the vice president. I've forgotten what those telegrams said. I'd received a visit and a letter from the governor of New York, but I've forgotten what that letter said. But there was another letter. It came from a little girl, a young girl, who was a student at the White Plains High School. And I looked at that letter, and I'll never forget it. It said simply, "Dear Dr. King, I am a ninth grade student, at the White Plains High School. She said, while it should not matter, I would like to mention that I'm a white girl. I read in the paper of your misfortune and of your suffering. And I read that if you had sneezed, you would have died. And I'm simply writing you to say that I'm so happy that you didn't sneeze. And I want to say tonight, that I too am happy that I didn't sneeze, because if I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1960, when students all over the South started sitting in at lunch counters. And I knew that as they were sitting in, they were really standing up for the best in the American dream and taking the whole nation back to those great wells of democracy which were dug deep by the founding fathers in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1961 when we decided to take a ride for freedom and ended segregation in interstate travel. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1962 when Negroes in Albany, Georgia decided to straighten their backs up. And whenever men and women straighten their backs up, they are going somewhere, because a man can't ride your back unless it is bent. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been here in 1963. The black people of Birmingham, Alabama, aroused the conscience of this nation and brought into being the Civil Rights Bill. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have had a chance later that year in August to try to tell America about a dream that I had had. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been down in Selma, Alabama, to see the great movement there. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been in Memphis to see a community rally around those brothers and sisters who are suffering. I'm so happy that I didn't sneeze. And they were telling me, now it doesn't matter now. It really doesn't matter what happens now. I left Atlanta this morning, and as we got started on the plane, there were six of us. The pilot said over the public address system, "We are sorry for the delay, but we have Dr. Martin Luther King on the plane, and to be sure that all of the bags were checked, and to be sure that nothing would be wrong on the plane, we had to check out everything carefully, and we've had the plane protected and guarded all night." And then I got into Memphis, and some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out, or what would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
Go ahead, go ahead.
So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.